Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 350 for Friday, April 17th. I am at the Westgate Resort and Casino, just checked into my room, and now I'm looking for registration to register for New Media Expo, NMX.
All right.
Yes, this is where I register for NMX.
Are you already registered?
Yep. I do.
And your last name?
Edgerly. E-D-G-E-R-L-Y. Len.
What's that? Maybe you need a little finger here.
I'm podcasting. Yeah. Taking my listeners through the whole experience, including the very start of it right here.
Glad you started with us.
That's it.
There's your badge. Let me get your bag.
All right.
Our show office is around the corner in that built-in, should you have any questions and need help and we're not here.
Okay.
And then finally, our booth is in the North Hall, smack middle. Go over, give our exhibitors some love, and stop by our booth.
Great.
Okay, I'll have an email.
I listened to last year's show, and that gave me a taste of how much fun it is to be at one of these. I think I'm going to take a little different approach. Last year, it seemed like I was asking everybody if they were reading on a Kindle, and as another year goes by, I'm not so interested in that. I don't know. It seems like everybody's reading on a Kindle, or they're not. So I'll be looking for more things about books, reading, changes in reading, but things that just seem to be new or coming catch my attention, and therefore I hope will be of interest to you. So I don't have quite as clear an agenda on what I'm looking for. Just heard Tom Webster's talk about how podcasting has been growing steadily but not dramatically in the last 10 years since he's been doing analysis of it for Edison Research. And he had a provocative point to make about how if you get trapped in thinking that what you're doing is podcasting, you're missing the chance to grow with the consumption of audio content in a broader way. And I've always been sort of a fan of the word podcast, but after his talk, I think I can see that it's likely to fade from public consciousness as a word that has a lot of meaning and power, similar to the way blog has faded. There was a time when, you know, if you were a blogger, you were Andrew Sullivan, it was just sort of a thing. And Sullivan, of course, ended his blog, and now there's just lots of writing on the internet. There's Medium, there's Wattpad, there's all these different ways of communicating with people through text. And so if you had just defined yourself as a blogger and refused to take advantage of some of these new forms, you could have missed the future. We've switched in time and place to Friday morning, April 17th, 2015, in my room here at the Westgate Resort and Casinos. As NMX picked up steam during the week, I jumped into the swirl of presentations, conversations in the hall, and general high energy of an event like this, so I didn't keep up that live commentary with my portable recorder. So the rest of this episode will comprise two extended interviews that I record, and I hope you're going to enjoy them. The first is with Robert Martin, director of the Isaacson School for New Media at Colorado Mountain College in Aspen and Glenwood Springs, Colorado. His lecture style was low-key, my image of a hip young professor at a mountain college, but his message I found provocative and inspiring. The title was A Visual Narrative, How Images Changed Our Brains and Our Stories. He readily agreed to my request that he place my Zoom H1 recorder in his shirt pocket with a lapel mic on his shirt so I could get a high-quality full recording of his entire talk. I may use that later this fall when I'm going to be traveling. I'm going to have to put some episodes in the can. Of all the speakers that I heard at NMX this year, Robert Martin is the one who I think offered the most compelling view of what's ahead in storytelling of all kinds. I began by asking him to describe the school where he works.
The Isaacson School itself started about 3 years ago. We've been running full-time with lots of full-time students now for about 2 years. I was brought in as the director 2 years ago. It's another one of those rhizomatic things that we talked about in the talk, where kind of ideas percolated up. No one really came up with a single idea of the Isaacson School. A lot of faculty in different areas said this is a really interesting idea. engage Walter Isaacson, who said we need to have a school that teaches this. Since then, we've brought in, we've got graphic design and photography, both which approach those through new media ideas. We've got digital media, marketing, digital journalism, and digital production, which is video. And that all totals about 150 or 160 students up in Glenwood and Aspen, Colorado.
Are there classes that those students take to learn how to write more effectively in the age of new media, or what do you teach them about writing words?
Yeah, we actually start them out in a visual communications curriculum. They learn the Adobe products, and they learn how to draw and paint and all that kind of fun stuff. And at the same time, they're taking introduction and foundations to reporting, and another class that we call Internet Media, in which they learn writing for Twitter and blogs and sort of short writing.
The big picture that you sketched as a way to help people understand your vision of the future had a surprising take on Gutenberg and the invention of the printing press, which frequently is said that was a huge moment. Why did you say it wasn't?
Well, it's still a huge moment, but it's not a shift in the way that we interpret communication. And so the printing press is a distribution method. It allows them to get more of it out, but it's not actually changing the way that we interpret the content. Whereas photography changes the way we interpret the content. That visual piece really changes exactly how we see what we see. I mean, it's what you see. Whereas text will always allow interpretation.
And text, to learn how to read, there's some research. There's a professor at Tufts, I think, Wolf, who's written about the mind, what the mind has to go through to learn how to read, and using dyslexia and other things. What you're talking about is sort of the original way of perceiving the world through the five senses.
Right.
And is your view of it that we sort of are coming full circle back to a more immediate perception of reality than we've had this sort of a 500-year diversion into a way that's just more difficult to actually get reality through?
In a way, I think it is. I think we will always use the text. I don't think we can get away with it. I think it's very specific in the way that we interpret the world through words. So I don't think it's going to go away, because I think that what we'll see is more trust issues. Kind of photography has gone through this do we trust photography or not? And I think virtual reality is going to even bring that more to the forefront, where we're going to say, well, it's the Matrix. Am I in the Matrix or am I not in the Matrix? It's kind of a frightening place to exist. So I think it'll take a while for people to trust those types of methodologies. And until then, they need to be engaged in a way that probably leverages what's called the uncanny valley.
What's that?
There's research by a guy named Miro in Japan, who's a roboticist, and this is probably 20 years old now. His research talks about this thing called the uncanny valley, where when robots become more closely identifiable as humans, people trust them less. So we actually want robots to be something that is boxy and clunky and more like Rosie from the Jetsons than we want them to be something that looks just like us. When it looks like us, we have this uncanny valley they fall into. We think they're zombies, or we think that they're too uncanny for us to trust. And so I think for a long time, when we work with virtual reality and augmented reality, it's going to have to be kind of cartoony for people to trust it.
When you think about books and the role of books now, it's a very one-dimensional way to get information to a reader, from a writer to a reader. And the part that just seems to have had difficulty taking off is enhanced e-books, you know, which you could read on an iPad. You couldn't read them on an e-ink book, but right. Anything that gives you all of that. Based on your research and what you're doing at the school, can you see why enhanced ebooks have been so slow to take off? They basically now look like it's a textbook and somebody just strips in, click here to see a video of the author talking about something. But what's missing that is really going to lead them to have the success that it seems obvious they should have?
I think kind of the quick answer to that is that the tools aren't there for designing ebooks in a really deep and lush way yet. They exist, but they're kind of hard to access. So getting an ebook to look like Time magazine used to look, where it was lush and people could just access it very quickly, is a really difficult task. I think the other piece behind that becomes when we are building the ebook, it's the drivers for the readers are so different that it actually reconfigures in between them.
the drivers for each reader is different?
Yeah. So essentially, e-books are they're not really a derivation of CSS and HTML, but they kind of look like that. And so a browser interprets CSS and HTML in different ways. This is why when you go to Firefox, a web page might not run a video, but it does when it's on Chrome or vice versa. Very similar with ebooks. The readers that actually are in there are written by different companies, and the drivers are on different types of devices. And so because they're different each time, we don't know how necessarily to build something that is consistent each time. I think once we crack that, we'll start to see more of it. But at the same time, they're also so small. I think people really want to see their video full frame. So we need to have a way that you can come in, and when you look at that video, you can click on it, and you can leave that text experience and enter a video experience. Until I see that happening consistently between ebooks, it's not something that I'm too excited about. We teach it, our students get confused by them, I guess, because it's tough to repurpose content between things. I just had a student do an internship, and he's so excited about it because his internship is with a radio station, and his whole internship is we take our radio shows and put them on the blog in a way that people engage with them. It's kind of like where I think eventually we'll go with e-readers. How do we take this type of content, this mainly textual still content, and there will be people who have the skills and the experience to move that into a multimedia kind of a presentation.
The technological challenges are really daunting, and then you've got so many different kinds of devices.
Yeah.
If that was all solved, it seems like you would still have a challenge, because for people who love to read, real book lovers, there's that sense that you're zoning into the story, you immerse yourself in the text, and there's something disruptive about going out of it. You've
right.
kind of broken the trance. But and you talked about the Snowfall piece that the New York Times did that seemed to have solved some of that problem. But how would you coach somebody creating in the world we don't have yet, where the tools will be easy to maintain the trance or immersion of a story in text and still enrich it with these other forms?
Well, clearly you need a giant team to produce everything you do. I think part of the success of Snowfall is in the fact that their typography was exquisite. They really put a lot of effort to make it look like a book. And so it didn't feel as much like you were leaving that trance, as you said, when you were looking at the video, because when you went back, it was still a very high level of production on the typography. So there's that piece, sort of learning that typography and design to be able to get people to come back to it and still feel like it's a very professional thing. At least my experience with the students loved Snowfall, but the students generally went through and didn't read the text when I watched them. I always just show it to them, and they get to play with it. And they'll look at all the media first, and then they'll go back and they'll read, which is an utterly opposite way that I approached it or somebody who really loves books approach it. I think the answer isn't that we come up with one solution. We come up with solutions that work most of the way for most of the people and allow people to access it from their own point of view. And so you can come into Snowfall from the video, you can come into the Snowfall from the graphics, or you can come into it from the text, and you're kind of equally satisfied.
Do you have children?
I do.
What ages?
I have a 4-year-old boy and a 6-year-old daughter.
I've got grandchildren sort of that age, and my daughters are they want their sons to learn to read. And so it's still, in their view, a privileged capability they want to make sure their children have. When you come at this with all that you know, are you as worried about whether your children are going to be great readers? Wouldn't you want them to be able to be very savvy consumers of all kinds of media?
Ideally, I want them to be both. I struggle with this a lot. I see there's huge value in my life for reading. Everything from long road trips with the family that gave me an escape to just simply I immerse myself in reading a lot of different things every day. In order to have my kids to be really savvy consumers, I'm kind of really deliberate about this is reading time, this is time on Minecraft, this is time when you're watching videos, and thinking about what that mix is. I believe that we're kind of replacing our brains a little bit with our cell phones. I remember growing up as a child, I had probably 70 or 80 phone numbers memorized. I have no need for that anymore. They exist on the phone. I've essentially added more RAM by having this remote memory. So I think that there's going to be stuff that we have to be very deliberate about what we force them to memorize. I just had a long conversation with my daughter's first grade teacher, and I said, well, are you going to make them at some point memorize the Constitution or the Bill of Rights? You know, what is it? What are the kind of big things that they need to know? And what are the things that we can just look up? Because if I have this ability to look anything up, do I need to know the Bill of Rights or do I need to instantly be able to bring it up? And I don't have the answers to that. But I think that it's a conversation we need to be having culturally so that we're teaching the appropriate things in school. Because by and large, schools almost ignore media consumption. It's not something they're taught how to do, but they are taught how to read. And that's somewhat the danger of having this kind of experiential, very immersive media of video that they use a lot, because the kids don't have to work to learn it. They can just consume. Whereas with words, we have to work to learn it. And so I think there's some value in that just from learning how to work, in essence.
Yeah, you get sort of the habits of work.
Right.
I think it helps explain to me how come if I'm reading a book and it's a book that I care about and my mind is actively trying to pull the meaning out of these marks on a page versus watching really well done TV, Breaking Bad, one of these shows that almost has a literary quality to it in terms of plot and character, all the things that are prized in good writing. It's more passive. At the end of the same amount of time, there's some sense of that the reading left me more satisfied, some better state of mind than a similar period of time just watching something, even though the thing I'm watching is very high quality.
Sure.
Do you think the difference is the work I had to put into pulling the meaning out of the older technology?
I think that makes sense. It's a more passive form of consumption, if you will. I mean, we're still consuming the words, but there's a whole section of codification happening within your brain, that process of semiotics. And that work can be very rewarding, I guess, and I think that makes sense.
But by the same token, I've seen research that says that when you're experiencing something in video, and you know, you talked about smell-o-vision, and say you have all this stuff coming, the brain is going to be lit up in many different sectors compared with whatever part of the brain has been trained to bring the text in.
I haven't seen those. I'd love to see PET scans in three different phases. I saw PET scans years and years ago of what changed between consuming a video and touching a video and answering questions. If you haven't seen it, you should look up Treehouse, which allows you to interact with video and kind of choose your own story endings. Some of them are really well done and some are terrible. But I imagine that as people are interacting, it shifts what lights up in the brain in video. And I haven't seen that included with what happens when I read, and specifically what happens when I read different genre. You know, is there something when I have a highly imaginative horror story that I'm reading, I imagine things light up very differently, and I'm engaged in a very different manner when I'm visualizing in my brain than I might be if I'm reading a technical manual. So I think it probably depends a little bit on the genre you're reading, and also on the probably your engagement with the material in general.
Last question: when you think 5 or 10 years ahead for your school, and a session like this where you're presenting something that feels pretty new to most of us, I think, do you expect that it's going to change that quickly to where if you face a group of people at a content creation type event like NMX, people will just be living in that world that at this point you're kind of inviting them to imagine?
I hope so. Things generally move slower than I think they will. I very specifically create about one assignment a semester for our students where they're looking far ahead. You know, this assignment where they're creating a 3D world that they walk through on their website. Is very deliberately chosen to kind of say, okay, this isn't what you're going to get out of school and do, but how do you leverage all the knowledge that you have to approach this? It's really a problem-solving exercise for them, and I think that's when I look 5 years down the road, that's all I want out of my students is that they become excellent problem solvers, and that's what I want out of the audience here, because as they have a big picture of what communication can do from their perspective, then they have a reason why they're choosing video or an immersive technology or augmented reality or something completely out there that they've never approached. But they have this understanding of the way that the mind works. And that will allow them to make good choices, hopefully, as they move forward.
That's great. Thanks very much.
Sure. Thank you.
The second interview I'd like you to hear is back down on the ground in the nitty-gritty of a tech startup named Clammr. That's C-L-A-M-M-R. I had heard of Clammr before NMX and have mentioned the app on the show, and I knew that they would have a booth here, so I made sure to go there the first day, and I ended up spending quite a bit of time with the co-founders, Parviz Parvizi and David Silverman. This conversation with Parviz took place at the booth, so there's a fair amount of crowd noise from the show. He and his co-founder, David Silverman, met when they were both students at Yale Law School. They worked for big companies for about 6 years after that, and last year left very good-paying jobs to create a platform that, for me, was pretty much the star of NMX this year. That's because it has such obvious potential to help podcast creators and fans spread excerpts of shows to larger audiences. Clammr can do the same thing for musicians, and as you'll hear, they got their start at the Berklee School of Music, setting up their embedded as entrepreneurs. Here is the interview, which begins, understandably, for a startup based on the sharing of 18-second audio excerpts with a concise description of the company.
Clammr is a bite-sized audio platform. A lot of our users are calling us Audio Twitter or Audio Instagram.
Which do you think is closer, Audio Twitter or Audio Instagram?
I think Audio Twitter, and the reason is a lot of people use Twitter as a discovery tool. That's a social discovery tool where friends are tweeting out short descriptions with a link that they can then jump into. And a lot of the value of Clammr comes from acting as a front-end discovery vehicle for audio. Now, people can create short Clammrs as standalone, and those are great for a news power feed or just some really funny things people do. But another aspect of Clammr is you hear these short bites, and then there's a hear more option where you can launch an entire podcast after you've heard one of the best moments in that podcast.
Talk a little about the genesis of the startup. What was the idea that led you and your partner to get it going?
Yeah, so David and I, we're the co-founders, along with Ken and Oren. David and I have known each other for almost a dozen years. We actually met on the very first day of law school a long time ago. And David was a professional musician before law school, and I'm a lifelong nerd. Ironically, even though we went to law school, we're actually both pretty slow readers. So we actually prefer to take a lot of our information in on audio. I listen to a lot of audio books. I actually, you know, for years I've listened to The Whole Economist in audio every week. And you know, when you train yourself to actually listen faster, it can get pretty efficient. So David and I would often exchange things with each other that would be interesting things we've learned either from podcasts or audio books. We'd send each other a little note and saying, hey, check this out. And then you know, it just kind of sprung from our foreheads. Really, David initially had that initial inspiration. Why isn't there something like an audio Twitter? Why can't we just grab the little thing that we want and share that with each other? And once that little itch started to emerge, we just couldn't keep from scratching it. It just became so apparent to us that that was something that was necessary. When you look at the media landscape, you see that there's this trend, it's really an inexorable trend, toward bite size. And every flavor of media has gone toward bite size. You have text, Twitter, video, Vine, images, Instagram. But there's no bite-sized audio. And audio actually has a social problem and a discovery problem. Audio is not very social. You look at Facebook feeds, there are a lot of viral videos. There are a lot of viral images with text. There are no viral audio pieces. Why is that? We couldn't answer that question as to why. There wasn't a really good reason why that was, other than really no one had put together the pieces into a user-friendly platform to make that happen. So we created Clammr.
What's the relationship between the music content on Clammr and kind of the news tech content?
Yeah, it's. We didn't want to prejudge things, so we kept Clammr, we have kept Clammr open to really virtually anyone. And we've tried to introduce Clammr to a lot of different communities. For ourselves, our starting point has really been podcasts. because we're lovers of podcasts and really also audiobooks, and also kind of short news bites. We find that's compelling for us, but we didn't want to be kind of closed-minded about it, so we ended up embedding in the Berklee College of Music. They have this amazing program there. It's the Institute for Creative Entrepreneurship, and it's launched and led by a gentleman named Panos Panay, who himself is a Berklee grad and a successful entrepreneur who created a company called Sonic Bids that he subsequently sold to the company that owns Billboard magazine. And they're basically a marketplace that puts together musicians with promoters. And we embedded there and actually had four Berklee students working with us, and they spread clamor in the Berklee community, and it really took off, and people were very interested. And then we reached out to people who are just independent musicians and found that there's a real need among independent musicians to get themselves out there. And folks may not want to listen to their full 3-minute song, but getting that hook, that's this short hook that's 18 seconds or less, can be a way to expand their reach. And so we've had a lot of interest from musicians. So we're a little bit of everything. The same way, you know, YouTube has, some people only think of it as a music video source, and then other people think of it as the place where they listen to college lectures, and then other people cat videos, right? And it's about having a platform and then letting really creators do what they want with it.
Well, the thing that excites me is the idea that if I have somebody listen to my podcast, it's a 45-minute show, there's always an interview, and there might be a great 18 seconds of an interview. And it's pretty exciting to think that some of my loyal listeners would be able to, without any friction or as little friction as possible, go from, wow, I want to share that, to having it show up on in various places. So thinking of someone of average ability to do this, and if you were sitting down with them and say, okay, you want to help spread Len's content by Clamor, what are the steps they would take?
One thing we've done with Clamor is we've definitely done the parent test. You know, both of our sets of parents, my mom's actually a really big iPhone user. Frankly, she's a more skilled iPhone user than me, certainly on emojis and things like that. So maybe that wasn't the best test, but actually, she uses Clamor, and she creates Clamors. And here are the steps. So you have the Clamor app, you download that. We're on iOS today. And you simply go to the record button on Clamor, and when you hit the record button, it gives you the option to pull in audio from any source. And so you hit the library option, and you go to your podcasts that are in your library, and you just select the podcasts that you like. So select Len's podcast and grab the episode that you want, and what you get is a beautiful red bar that's a waveform, and you can launch a waveform that shows the exact audio wave, and you just scroll through that to the exact section or piece that you want. With your finger, you can go up and down, grab the exact spot, press done. And you can even resize it to make it less than 18 seconds. And we have some really neat stuff like multi-tracking, where you can even add your own voice and do a little voice intro yourself to the beginning of the clip. And you just hit post, and it automatically goes both to Clamor and also Facebook and Twitter. And it has the Hear More link, so anybody who hears that clip and says, you know what? That's a pretty cool podcast. I should check it out. Can immediately launch Len's podcast from it.
And they would be launching that particular episode that the Clamor was based on?
That's right. That specific episode would launch. So it's a way for your fans and your audience to actually engage socially with your great content.
Would you also be able to send the Clamor to as a text message to somebody?
Absolutely. So when you create a Clamor, there are a few... We created Clamor as an open platform, and so any Clamor that gets created can be posted to Facebook or Twitter or sent as a text message or by email. Also, every Clamor and every account is an embeddable object, so they can go to a simple website that we have, enter the name of your podcast or your account, and then we generate a little snippet for them. And they copy-paste that onto their website or onto their Tumblr page or anywhere else, and they'll get a little widget that shows an image with a big play button and any text that was there, and then anybody can just press play with that. So it's really quite shareable. It's really taking this amazing content that's inside podcasts and opening it up to the world by letting the super fans sort of chop it up and share it with people in these bite-sized, kind of digestible units.
What's an example of something that your mother has shared on Clamor?
Okay, so my mom, one thing she likes to do is, we have a feature that's a remix feature. So you can actually make Clamors out of Clamors. So somebody could post a Clamor, and then you might say, I really like that. I'll add a little audio snippet to the front of that. And one thing that's been really popular, actually across genders, is we have a food channel where there are these 18-second recipes. And one of the folks who does these 18-second recipes just describes them in a way that can't help but make your mouth water. And he has these 18-second recipes that he puts on there, and then you would click to get really the full recipe. He kind of gives you the pricey. So my mom loves those. And she actually likes to share the show, remix those, put a little bit of an audio snippet for me at the beginning and say, hey, you know, this reminds me of something you're going to like, and then shares that with me. So she's a fan of that. That's the thing that jumps out the most. And some of the newsy stuff, yeah, too.
And so she's sharing it to you as a text or an email, or how do you get it?
She's actually posting it to Clamor.
And you follow her on Clamor, so you see it.
Yeah, so anybody you follow, so you can follow channels or accounts, some, you know, a podcast, something that's more produced, or a news source. You can follow individuals as well. And any individual who you're following, any Clamor they post comes into your feed. In fact, any Clamor they like comes into your feed. And we have a deduper so that if you're following five people and they all like the same thing, you're not going to hear that five times. But it's a form of social curation, basically.
How difficult is it going to be to get an average internet user as comfortable with this as we've grown to be of copying and pasting a URL to a Twitter to tweet out something we've read in the New York Times?
Yeah, here's the neat thing about that. When you think of something like a YouTube, and I said, you know, audio Twitter, and I think YouTube's also a good analogy, though we're short form. The percent of people who are actually producing content for YouTube is very small, something like 1%. So we expect the folks who are actually grabbing these moments that they love from a podcast won't be all your listeners or all the listeners of a podcast. It'll be a small set. It'll be the real power users. The average listener, and really when you look at social media, what happens is the average listener, the role they play is a social curation role. They're actually amplifying the things that people initially create. You go on something like a Facebook and you see viral video or these viral funny memes. Most people aren't creating those. Not a lot of people are creating those funny pictures with captions, but they're actually picking the ones they like and resending them to other people. And that aspect of Clamor, even though the creation is very easy, as I described, but that aspect of, you know what, that was a great podcast, that was a great interview, that was a great little moment, I'm going to pass this on to everybody I know. That piece is a single bond.
That's right. You don't have to create something. You're just sending it on very easily.
Yeah.
You've got sort of the people that create the echo chamber versus the people that yell against the mountains.
Yeah. Yeah. You have the people who are sort of seeding, and then really the others are the kind of power echoers. And
right,
they're not everyone either, right? So we all have friends on Facebook who tend to be the ones who share more, who are the ones who are really generating more of the sharing. Even those folks, it's like, you know, the 1% that truly create, the 20-30% who are really kind of echoing most actively, and then, you know, the remainder of the population that's selectively truly taking the very funniest stuff. And it's a bit of a funnel of folks. And we want to get that kicking with audio. And we think there's just so much amazing content in audio that can be unleashed.
Yeah. I'm excited because you are at least partly a Cambridge, Massachusetts startup, and I live half the year in Cambridge. Where are you on sort of this as a startup? When did you start? How much, what did you get for investors? Where are you on the life cycle of an exciting startup?
Yeah, so we're a startup, and we've got some folks who are really quite experienced and long in the tooth, which is great as a startup. So, you know, our core founding team of four folks, we have two folks on the business side who are have backgrounds at McKinsey in the media practice and Morgan Stanley in the Los Angeles M&A group, who really advised leading wireless carriers, leading virtually every media company type, and then leading transactors. And then on the tech side, we've got a terrific team of two other people who really built the social network that is part of Cornerstone On Demand, which is the largest publicly traded tech company in LA, and then have built sites for top brands like Nestle and other sites and apps. We've got this great, strong team. We pulled the full team together right around September, and late fall, we got a seed round of funding together, really primarily individuals who had kind of 1 or 2 degrees of separation, who are really, actually, we love our investors because they're quite savvy in the media space. We're talking about folks, several of them are on public company boards, some are at investment funds, investing in a personal capacity. So they're really a great sounding board. And we've been heads down on product and users. So we, very early on, before we were even anywhere near released, we pulled together a crew of beta users who weren't our friends and family and wives, but were objective third-party folks, and they were using Clamor daily and filling out a daily and weekly survey for us to really get user feedback. And we've, since that kind of pulling the team together in September, built the app. We released it quietly on the App Store, really this kind of early spring, late winter, and are just now coming out and sharing it with the world. Our seed round is enough to keep the product team kind of going for a while, and so we're in good shape there. And we'll obviously look to generate revenue and likely take on some additional funding as we really start to ramp up the marketing and really just the communication about Clamor.
Will the world headquarters be in Cambridge or LA?
We are formally LA. That's what we formally. I think the reality is, in today's world, we're so virtual. David and I have worked with each other for 12 years. We met 12 years ago. Ken and Oren have known each other and worked together for 10 years. So, the way it's working out right now is a lot of the product is in LA. Funny enough, ironically, even though Boston's such a tech place, and actually a lot of the community development capacity is in Cambridge and in Boston. But the reality is, we may have some new person join who's fantastic who may be in New York, and we're actually very okay with that. Yeah.
I mean, I can just see it's a natural initiative to imagine, because there have been, as you say, other types of media that have gone to the bit-sized shareable.
Yeah.
And it just looks like there's this one big area that hasn't been tapped yet. So
it got us to quit pretty well-paying jobs and give up some other lifestyle things, because it was just one of these itches that once you see it, you say, that needs to exist.
Right.
Why doesn't that exist? And we need to make it happen exist, right? So we need to make it exist. So anyway.
That's good. Thanks.
Thanks, Len. Really a pleasure.
With that introduction to Clamor, I really invite you to try Clamor. I know this will not be for everyone listening, but if you have a moderate level of confidence on trying out new tech and apps, you will find a step-by-step recipe for creating a Clamor, or maybe several Clamors, from this week's Kindle Chronicles. I'll have that up on the show notes. You will need to create a free Clamor account, and the easiest way to do the whole process is on an iOS device, an iPhone or an iPad. You can also use a website portal they have at publisher.clamor.com. Since I plan to stay in touch with Parviz and David, I would love to hear from you about your experience creating a Clamor for the show, so I can pass it along to them, something that I will be able to do in person with Parviz, who's based in the Boston area, and I look forward to connecting with him when Darlene and I get back to Cambridge in late May. These two were everywhere at NMX this week, working their hearts out on behalf of their startup. That alone was enough to endear them to me and make me believe they have a shot at turning this new platform into something that becomes more widely known and used. They're both plenty sharp and focused on doable objectives. The fact that their creation may turn out to be a tool to help my show and many others find larger audiences makes it even more exciting. I am headed back to Denver this evening with a 26-item to-do list in Evernote, where I always try to capture action items before I leave a conference. Tops on the list is to reach out to Rob Walsh at Libsyn, where I have hosted the show from the beginning. He's going to help me tweak my uploading process and guide me toward renaming the show. Sometime this year, I've decided, perhaps on August 30th when I turn 65, or maybe July 26th when the podcast will turn 7 years old, I plan to transition to The Reading Edge. That's a name I created as a separate show several years ago, and it's also the name I chose for the show's Facebook page, which you can find at facebook.com/TheReadingEdge. Another item is to spend more time on that Facebook page, because so many podcasters said it's simply the best and most widely used platform for connecting with listeners. I also plan to check two shows by interesting people I met, The Power of Moms podcast and Mark Ramsey's Media Unplugged. I'll have links to that in the show notes. Ramsey gave a terrific session with 7 action items to improve podcasts. One was his assertion that your podcast is too long. In a smaller group, I would have explained that mine is actually the perfect length, 44:58, and that a good way to avoid rambling, in my opinion, is to pick a specific ending time and stick to it, have that be sort of a fixed form. One thing I noticed at this show is the importance of voice in this business. Ramsey is a guy, he's kind of a slight-looking fellow, but he has this mellow, hypnotic-sounding voice, as does Adam Curry, the podfather, who was here in the audience at the 10th Annual Podcast Awards. Elsie Escobar of Libsyn gave a highly original session informed by her yoga expertise. She walked us through some exercises to bring our voices to a vibrant level of energy. Elsie said women should try speaking in a lower voice and men should try speaking in a higher voice to get out of cultural expectations of how we should sound and find our most natural register. At NMX, you can hear people walking around that have been gifted with voices that sound like a musical instrument as soon as they start speaking. And, you know, I like my voice fine. I've gotten some nice comments that it's easy to listen to. But, boy, once in a while, you're just in the presence of gods when it comes to the gifts that people have been given in their voice. I'll head back to Denver this evening on Southwest, my favorite way to travel. I'm not sure yet who I will be talking to for next week's show. While I've been here, Darlene, my wife, has been hosting a quilting workshop led by her teacher from Maine, Susan Carlson, who traveled to our home in Denver to conduct the workshop for 3 women and Darlene. So I look forward to seeing Darlene's next new creation, which is based on a photo that I took of her a year ago in the Netherlands. She was standing in a field of tulips wearing a bright orange coat, and she's going to render my very ordinary photo into something spectacular and vividly original colors. I can't wait to see it. Another thing I can't wait to see is the Kindle Voyage available in Canada. I heard from listener Stephen Kendall, who's been patiently waiting a long time to be able to buy a Voyage in Canada, and I passed his plaintive query about the plans along to a contact at Amazon. She replied, as I had expected, that Amazon does not discuss future product plans, but she did say she had passed Stephen's query along to the team. Here's hoping. I also passed along this sad story from listener Hassan Diwan, but I have not heard back yet if there's anything Amazon can do for him. Len, I recently took a flight back home from vacation. TSA forced me to check my backpack because it had a 7-ounce container of fragrance that I bought for my girlfriend on the trip. Not wanting to cause a scene, I obliged and resigned myself to putting my laptop and everything else that was in it into the plane's baggage hold. When I landed in San Jose, said girlfriend picked me up, we went home, ate, and finally I pulled out my Kindle to continue reading my book. I turned on the Kindle and noticed that the top third of the screen was blank. I reset the Kindle. When this didn't help, I printed out the TSA claim form. I got a response today saying they couldn't determine they were at fault. The cost of the device is hefty, but what's more important is that it was the first gift that my girlfriend's mother had given to me. To label me as upset is putting it mildly, and I didn't know where to turn, so I figured I'd tell the Kindle Chronicles. I appreciate that sentiment, and I did forward this on to Amazon, and I'm not sure what they can do, but it's a well-told story and a sad one. I'm sorry to hear about the fate of that Kindle that was delivered into the tender mercies of TSA. So this has been great fun. I feel like you send me off on these adventures, and I hope I gather things that are of interest to you. Music for my podcast is from an original Thelonious Monk composition named Well You Needn't. This version is Ra Monk by Eval Monegat on the Variations In Time, a Jazz Perspective CD by Public Transit Recording. This is Len Edgerly on the 24th floor of the Westgate Las Vegas Resort and Casinos for the Kindle Chronicles. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my show. Have a great day. Bye.